Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 101.
101. That's German.
Well, you know what today is, Lindsay?
What?
It is exactly 52 weeks to the day. It's a Thursday since our final performance of Babel because of the pandemic. It's not the right day of the year. The day was the 12th. Today's the 11th. But calendar wise, it's the second Thursday of March, which is when we shut down.
Oh, that's so sad. I thought I had one more day to like deal with this, these feelings.
Nope. Today's the day. We're reckoning with them today, live on the air.
No.
Well, actually, it's not live on the air, but it is on the air to some degree. It's crazy. I feel like the last 2 weeks have been very hard for me mentally. Like, I think it's just, it's a marathon, right, that we're all going through trying to get to the other side of this pandemic and be performing again or making shows again or, you know, just back to some sense of normalcy. And for those of us who, I don't know, find our identity in, you know, circus as an art form or theater or dance or any of this, not having that and now not having it for basically a year, has been pretty goddamn brutal.
Yeah, I have been dreading this day, to be honest, because it just feels like, wow, I can't believe it. It's been a year. Like, it can't be a year. It feels not like it's been a year, but it also feels like it's been 15 years. I really, really never thought the day we decided to just put Babel on hold. I just really remember never thinking it would ever be this long.
No, I mean, on the podcast we put out on March 17th of 2020, we guessed it would be like 30 days or 60 days or max 90 days. It's now been 12 months. It'll probably be a few more months. I guess it depends actually on where you are as to how many more months it will be until you're up.
Doesn't it feel like, I'm wondering though now if it's going to feel, it feels like, I remember feeling like, I can't believe it would ever be longer, you know, we'd ever be longer, shut down longer than 3 months. And now it's like, I can't imagine reopening, actually. Like, I know that we will eventually, but it almost feels like I can't even imagine it.
I mean, I feel like we can't imagine it, but we are sort of planning for it. Like, we are still planning full steam ahead to do our outdoor show, circus show, the summer, the reopen Babel in the fall. So,
I know,
you know, hopefully
just
the second
like,
half
what?
Of this year will be, you know, a whirlwind of shows happening. But it does feel like extremely far away. One good thing that we saw recently and we've talked about is the reopenings happening in Las Vegas. And since last we podcasted, a new update to the laws and regulations came out, removing the 25-foot moat between performers and the audience.
The moat never made sense. Never made sense. It was this arbitrary number that was like, if you're going to have a live performance, you need 25 feet between that performer and the audience member. And what about plane rides when you are not 25 feet away? You are not 6 feet away. What's the logic? Where did the 25 number come from? And they finally got rid of it.
Well, it just prevents lots of shows and small venues from reopening. And maybe it benefits you if you're like in a massive arena and being 25 feet away from Celine Dion isn't so hard. But if you're a show in Vegas where you're pretty close, whether that, you know, thinking Spiegelworld shows, this now allows more shows to reopen if you're your cabaret or you're just essentially like within 25 feet of the performer. And I think as somebody who produces and directs shows, I like to make shows where you can see the performer sweat and the emotions on their face. And that's what's wonderful about being closer than 25 feet is the physical distance you have from somebody doing something amazing.
Well, on Tuesday night, this past Tuesday, we, Josh and I, hosted a clubhouse room. I guess they're called Clubhouse Club.
Yeah, Clubhouse Room. I think that's
a Clubhouse Room. It's a new app called Clubhouse. Yeah, I think the jury's still out on how this app will evolve, if it will last, if people will be into it. But it's essentially like a live podcast where other people can talk, you can have a conversation, and it's not recorded. It's all audio. You don't see anyone. So no Zoom aspect, like no video. And we hosted a room and just like had anyone come who wanted to come.
Well, I feel like it was not almost like a greatest hits of the podcast when it came to guests. Like, we had Jay Gilligan, the amazing juggler from Sweden, American, but also from Sweden. We had Gypsy Snyder from The Seven Fingers, Mark Lonergan from Parallel Exit, Chris Lashua from Cirque Mechanics, Ruth Wickler from The Tohu. Kevin Catan is a stage manager at Spiegelworld. It was really just an awesome group of people.
We had a few clowns listening, like Mark Gindick.
Yeah, we had some few people listening in as well. Some people listening, some were talking. But it just sort of felt like we were doing a group podcast. And I'm glad it's not recorded, not because anybody said anything, but it's kind of fun that that only existed just for those who tuned in for it. We'll definitely do another one, maybe in a month or so. My issue with Clubhouse is that it's a little unfocused. Like, what's nice about the podcast is that Lindsay and I are talking just back and forth one-to-one, and then we'll add somebody in, and then it's three of us talking together, and Lindsay and I are very focused on making sure it's an interesting conversation, frankly. And with something like Clubhouse, where there's five or six people speaking, and it's going back and forth, it's a little harder to keep it on any kind of track. So it was interesting just to like sort of get a sense of how it worked functionally. We learned some really cool things. Kyla Ernst Alper joined the call, who runs Anvers Entertainment and is a Brooklyn-based circus artist who is doing and organizing all of the circus that's happening at Brooklyn Point, which is really the most active thing that's happening in the circus, I think, maybe in all of New York State, certainly in New York City. They're talking about putting performances on April 4th, and I feel like we got the scoop. So we'll have to have Kyla back on this show to talk about it soon. But if you're interested in making sure you catch the next Clubhouse chat, I know I said this in the podcast before, but I just can't stand the name of the app, Clubhouse. But if you're interested, download it, follow at Josh Avener, at Lindsay Maggot, and at Hideaway Circus, and you'll get a notification next time we do another one of these sort of group chats with past podcast guests and people who tune in.
It ended up being 2 hours when we thought it was just going to be an hour, which I guess it's basically a panel live for you to access anywhere in the world and at any time, as long as it's, you know, live. So I, in that sense, it's pretty cool. I think a panel is almost easier because there's a moderator and it's, you can visually motion to people and visually take cues from people of like, okay, this person wants to add something in or this person wants to speak. I found myself seeing when people would unmute themselves as like a cue that that person had something to add to the conversation. But it's challenging to like moderate it. But also I was so anxious the whole 2 hours because I don't like speaking. Like,
well, it's live.
It's live.
Those of you who like listen to our podcast, it's not really edited, but sometimes Lindsay and I start arguing, we disagree, we flub a line, and then I do edit it. But with Clubhouse, it's just like, you got to say it correctly right. The first time it's out of your mouth.
And in a way, I get less nervous when I have to speak in front of people in the same room because I can feel the energy. I can feel if people are, you know, tuning out to me. I can feel if people are interested in what I'm saying, so I can go further into that. But on Clubhouse, you're literally talking to like your phone and it's like, are people laughing at my jokes? Quote unquote jokes. Are people interested in what I'm saying? So it's kind of it's a hard app, but I did have a great time and it felt very good and motivating. And something that I said at the end is, you know, and Josh was saying, these times are very lonely because you're isolated from doing what you love and seeing people that you love. And having conversations like this are definitely a bit of a like uptick in your social box, even though you don't get to see everyone and be in the same room, but it's nice.
One last thing I realized it before we move on to a different topic. What's also, I think, nice about Clubhouse is just how public it is. So anybody could tune in. You could see, like, here's the thing, right? Like, we did the podcast. I know some of the people who we listened before. I talk to them one-on-one if I have a question about something that's happening. And a lot of that information is kind of private. But then in Clubhouse, anybody can tune in. There's no barrier to listening whatsoever. And in that way, it feels like very open and public and like a resource for a lot of people. And I like that aspect to it. Because sometimes when you have, I don't know what the right word for it is, but things that are more to do with focusing on businesses that already exist or companies that already exist, and it's people who are all working in the industry talking to one another, it doesn't give the chance for performers or people who are outside of that world to really listen to those conversations. And I think our podcast does that. And I think the Clubhouse also did that.
Yeah, it was cool because you can see like when people join, and a lot of people joined to listen and who I didn't know, but they were definitely circus performers because their, you know, little icon had them doing a, you know, aerial trick or a handstand or something. So you could tell that they were circus related, which was cool because it was like, oh, they found it, you know, and joined, and hopefully it was interesting. But we'll definitely do another one. I realized I never even posted on Instagram that we were doing it, but I honestly was like, let's just see how it goes first and learn a little bit about it and make sure we don't like totally mess it up. Yeah, it was fun.
You know, I think jumping onto another topic, Lindsay and I really do consider this podcast, particularly the interview part, like an oral history process. Like, I don't think we're so much like journalists where we're trying to get the scoop, but I do kind of feel like we play the role of historian a little bit in trying to get people's stories on record and have a real understanding of what happened with circus prior to our time on this earth. And for those of you who've been listening a lot, you'll know that we've been making more of an effort recently to get older folks on and stories of things that are happening really even prior to like the 70s or 80s. And there's somebody who we didn't manage to get on who passed away last week, who just had a phenomenal life story, who I think is worth mentioning here. Carlo Willenda, who was the last surviving performer of the original Willenda tight wire walking troupe that came over from Germany originally to the US to perform in Ringling. Carl Willenda was the patriarch of the family. Carla was his daughter. Her first time performing was when she was 6 weeks old on the tight wire with her parents. She passed away at age 85. And there's been a number of people in the circus community who've written really wonderful things. I know her granddaughter, Lyric Willenda Aristov, she posted such a wonderful history of her grandmother on Facebook. The New York Times had a really nice obit for her, including this quote.
Love it. So I guess a reporter asked once if she was related to Nick Willenda. And for those of you who need a refresher on Nick Willenda is the guy that you probably saw on TV walking a wire across Niagara Falls, across Times Square. I think he did one other like huge stunt. But, you know, someone asked her if she was a relative of his. And she said, no, he's related to me. I was here first. And I'm like, snaps for you, girl, because she was. And you read about her life story and she's amazing and she's so cute and she did the sway pole 85 feet in the air at age 81. I mean, it's amazing. She's so cool.
What I'm a little disappointed about not being able to get her story on the podcast before it was too late was her dad, her brother, one of her husbands all died while performing, which is of course incredibly tragic. But I don't know how many other people have that kind of experience. And the Willenda family is have not been strangers to awful performing tragedies. And then they continue to perform these super dangerous, super exciting stunts, you know, without safety wires, without
nets.
How
do you mentally get through that? I mean, I don't know. How do you mentally know that you have lost so many people that you love doing this act, and then you continue to act?
Yeah, it wasn't all the same act.
No, but it was her husband died doing sway pole. So it's like, how do you, one of her four husbands, which is also like, you go girl. But like, how do you, I mean, the mental strength that you must have as a person to do that, to continue to do that and continue to do it without safety net or a wire is just.
She joined the Circus Ring of Fame in Sarasota, Florida in 2019. So our thoughts go out to her family and those of you who knew her. If anybody has like a really nice story about her that you want to put on the air, record it on your phone and send it to us at hello@hideawaycircus. If it's something that we think we can share with others, we definitely will.
That's a great idea. And now in keeping with trying to get history recorded, we have our guest, Matthew Jessner.
I'm excited for you guys to hear Matthew. I think it's also a really interesting story to go right after Tom Schumacher's episode, which is episode 100, because both these gentlemen are from a similar era. They grew up in similar places and their whole paths diverged totally, but somehow ended up working in similar fields. So there's something interesting to hear when you listen to both episodes back to back. People will probably be most familiar with Matthew's work, probably at Dragon. He recently was the senior artistic director of operations. Prior to that, he was the chief show operating officer and casting director for them. He, for a short stint, worked as an artistic director for Cirque du Soleil. And prior to being on that side of the stage, he was a dancer and performer himself.
Also, he was in the show Cats by Andrew Lloyd Webber, which is one of my all-time favorite shows, even though it's ridiculously weird. And I could have probably gone into more questions about Cats, but I withheld my urge to ask about Cats.
Well, I really had a lot of fun talking to Matthew because he's incredibly smart. He's thought a lot about some very like challenging issues on show production, on what makes things good or bad, how to set up stuff so that it succeeds. When I say set up stuff, I mean set up shows in various places so that they succeed. As somebody who's just performed all over the world, been on stage, been off stage, worked as a director, a casting person, then an operations person, he really has a very, very diverse set of experiences and views on what is going on with circus in the world, what was going on with circus in the world, and what might or might not change coming out of it. Recently, he started a new 4-part series on Circus Talk called the 3 R's, Review, Rethink, and Regenerate, which are all surrounded around the topics of how do we review, rethink, and regenerate circus as we come out of the pandemic. I think you guys will really enjoy this episode and interview with Matthew. There's a lot to learn in it.
Yes, Matt, one thing I feel like I say a lot with guests is I love when a guest has very strong opinions about something and is articulate in those opinions, because it allows for the conversation to progress in a way that if you kind of have a general opinion or you don't want to say your opinion, it's harder to, you know, it feels more meandering. And this conversation is not meandering. He has such great opinions and strong opinions, and I loved listening to them.
But before we let you listen to the episode,
if you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter tweet us, even though we don't use Twitter.
You can follow us on Clubhouse now and at Hideaway.
Oh yeah. Follow us on Clubhouse at Hideaway Circus or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. And without further ado, here is our interview with Matthew Jessner.
Matthew, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited to talk with you. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
I'm in Brussels, Belgium.
Are you Belgian originally? Where did you grow up?
To the extent that I ever grew up, I grew up in the U.S. I spent 27 years in the U.S. and then went on vacation and then never came back. So there was no political statement, and I'm not 28. Yeah, so I've lived in Europe for 35 years now, and living in Belgium is kind of where I've landed, actually.
Where in the U.S. did you growing up in?
Hatched in New Mexico, and then moved to the real South, which was North Carolina and Louisiana, and that was a full-on Southern boy as a child. But then when I moved to California, having a Southern accent was a little bit odd, because one assumes that if you have a Southern accent, that somehow you must be an imbecile. So I learned how to actually sort of, how should I say, whitewash, if you will, my English, and then lived in Berkeley, California for many years, and then started dancing in the San Francisco Ballet in 1975, thank you. And then we joined another smaller company, and we toured all over the U.S. So I toured the U.S. before USA Today, before people in Kentucky even knew what yogurt was and all the rest of it. So
I saw, though, in another interview you did, prior to dance, you were doing martial arts.
Yeah, actually.
What kind of martial arts?
I did Shotokan Karate, just the real basic Okinawan ABC. I mean, it wasn't very exotic, but I was lucky enough to have a sensei who came from Japan, and he just taught us by showing us how to do it. And actually artistically the first discipline I ever undertook was Hindustani classical music, which is North India. It's kind of weird, but you know, it's the Bay Area. I don't want to talk about the substances that we smoked that weren't necessarily Camel, but I hung out with adults and played Indian music, and then got into martial arts. And the martial arts cleaned up my act, actually, quite honestly.
Were you already sort of inclined towards performing? And I mean, the martial arts is definitely, I can imagine, the overlap with dance, with, you know, the level of like jumping and flexibility and strength needed. But what was that transition like? Did you know you wanted to do ballet?
It was funny, actually, because I was recruited by, I'm one of the few people that wasn't recruited by, you know, looking for a social environment. And I want to avoid any stigma about classical dance, but it just so happened that there were a lot of pretty girls there, and I spent more time looking at pretty girls. But that wasn't the trip. That really wasn't the trip. What actually happened is I was brought by my father, who was a physicist and a mathematician and had absolutely nothing to do with the arts, but grew up in New York City. And as a Jewish refugee, anyway, longer story. But anyway, he took me to go see the Joffrey Ballet when I was younger, because he'd seen me in a competition doing karate, and I was winning the competitions, but he saw the kata, which was all the form. And he said, okay, You have to be tough in ballet. But with the way that, with the detail that you have in kata, you should look at dance. So my physicist and mathematics professor father took me to Joffrey Ballet in the mid-70s. And then I was smitten, so to speak. And then went on and undertook dance. And that was how many sort of university professor fathers of that generation would sort of push their kid into dance, which is one of the most precarious things you can ever do. But anyway, that's how that started.
Did you enjoy ballet? I mean, I know like ballet is so structured and very, you know, you have a way of doing it. And I guess that's karate too. I don't know as much about karate, but did you ever venture into other dance forms, or were you like, ballet is my thing?
Well, at that time I was quite fortunate because first of all, the ballet vocabulary is like the grammar. Of course, within gram or whatever, forms of modern dance that are completely different lexic, really. It's not a variant on the theme by any means, but still, even Martha Graham had studied for many, many years the classical forms. So the classical forms are sort of a staple to everything. And then the degree to which you learn different dialects, and I'm not expecting them to be derivatives, but I was fortunate enough to do a lot of neoclassical and a lot of very, very hardcore modern dance as well, because I was working in a repertory company that kicked our booty. And somehow the martial arts, the aspect of you just do it, really did translate pretty well into ballet, because you just do it and you don't do it for the cash, that's for sure.
When you were in the rehearsal room and learning these pieces, was there a part of you that was like, I want to be on the other side of this? Like, how did that sort of inclination come
to
be?
Wait, but we can't skip over all of his performing because I want to talk about Cats.
Don't. Well, that was later. I mean, Cats was a drunken whim, and then all of a sudden it became a job. But anyway, that was – so actually that question is really interesting, because rather than talk about myself, what I'd like to go a little bit into this is something about curiosity. And I don't feel that curiosity is sort of a whimsical state. It's due to passion. So I was fortunate enough, and I will use only one anecdote because I'm an older person, so I could give lots of them. I was performing in a season whereby the American composer Aaron Copland, with two A's, Aaron Copland, was actually conducting some of his own works with the San Francisco Symphony. So he came in and we were doing a ballet, which is called The Tenderland, which was an opera suite that he had actually written. And it had been choreographed by a man named Eugene Loring. Anyway, long history. And another ballet called Billy the Kid, which actually preceded Appalachian Spring, which was his opera ballet for Martha Graham. And then also another thing, which is called Seascape, but it was written of a clarinet concerto that he wrote for Benny Goodman. So this incredibly iconic American composer, who actually trained with a woman named Nadia Boulanger in Nice, taught him all about orchestration and worked under Ravel in the old days. Okay, I knew about all these things before there was the internet. There was no surfing. You walked to the library, and what wasn't there wasn't even on a database. You had to write to publishing houses to find out what they had actually been doing those days. So the degree of grit that you had to have as a performer was incredible. So the natural selection factor was quite high. Anyway, Aaron Copland came in to conduct a season, and he came in like the day before to conduct orchestra, and we'd been rehearsing to tape the whole time. And everyone was out on a dinner break and all the rest of it, and they all just kind of left like rats while this composer was going to actually direct the orchestra in the first orchestra rehearsal. And even from a pragmatic standpoint of Tempe, you want to know what he's going to do. You've been working to a tape, like a reel-to-reel tape, not any kind of DVD tape, like the whole thing. You have to like string it all through. And this man is going to be conducting the symphony with different orchestration, different nuances, different tempi, and you're not going to pay attention to this. And all of everyone left the building like rats, except for myself. And I wasn't doing it because I was so brilliant. I was just curious. And I was sitting in the orchestra, not in the orchestra pit, but in the orchestra, quite a few rows back. And he turned around and like screamed into the house, into a black, said, "Is there anybody here that knows the tempi?" And I'm like, "Oh man, what's this?" I kind of raised my hand timidly and said, "Come sit here. You have to tell me what the tempi are." I said, "I'm sorry, sir. It's your music." He said, "Look, there's a performance tonight. This is the only rehearsal. If you tell me the tempi, this is going to be a train crash." And I was like, okay. So I, as an 18-year-old young dancer, was dictating the tempi for that performance in the War Memorial Opera House for Aaron Copland, because everybody else was gone. But they all came back after dinner break with their little programs and had him sign for their scrapbooks. But they missed him directing the orchestra, talking to the strings and saying, Lena, cellos, this isn't Schubert. So this is what you do in terms of the other side, or you learn the choreography on the other side, or you sit out in the audience and you watch the lighting, or you listen to the sound levels and you watch what the directors are creating in which you participate as a physical instrument, or even the dramaturgy, or read the book. If the book, if the ballet is about a story, try reading the story. So if one doesn't have that degree of curiosity and engagement in the fact that the dance language is a theatrical one, which is why dance is not in the Olympics, because it ain't a sport. If you don't have that passion, well, then you might look good in tights, but there's not much else happening.
But why not? Why was your path not sent down the, like, I want to be a choreographer? Because I think that's what most dancers spin into who see themselves flipping. They don't see the directing, casting, producing opportunity. They see the thing they are in the room with, the person teaching them the dance.
Because they only see the room with a very narrow thing. You're still, when you're in the theater, you're in the room with all that. So it's not a question of being, it's just a question of bandwidth, really. I think that when you're working on a piece which is being composed as you're working on it, that's fascinating. So the composer is actually writing music corresponding to what's actually evolving as the piece in front of you. So to be a ballet master, of course, we're always learning choreography and teaching it to other people or from other people. That's one bandwidth, and it's incredibly important. But having a career after your capacity to perform should not be a B plan. It should be something that's an evolution in terms of just statistics. If you have a company of 100 people, one director, male, female, or whichever, and then down from that, the percentage of recycling into that is incredibly small. And also, we also know from any performing events, having done it for decades or even doing it well does not make of you necessarily a teacher. Then there's pedagogy. So you don't just, as you say, spin into it. It's a question of evolution. I think I was quite fortunate to have been widely exposed artistically, and it ripped open my curiosity. So I think that's what happened in terms of myself. Also, I was not going to school, and so I didn't waste too much time studying. Oops.
What was there something that you just saw that you were like, and so inspired by that you like? I feel like there's like a show for everyone when they're younger. That's like that's the show that made me just say this is like what I have to do.
Correct. Well, it's what you say is correct. It goes many ways. There are catalytic events along our lives, really. And that's why people talk about a career path, and I just have to laugh, because a career only makes sense when you look at it backwards, because it's actually quite circuitous, and you read it backwards and you start to understand that the odd opportunistic links that did all that. I don't want to talk about fate or destiny or karma or whatever, because it's a bit esoteric, but there are catalytic events, and some of them are actually painful. Some of them, like, we're not going to do this. And some of them are, we are going to do this. So one of the catalytic events that you mentioned was seeing the Joffre Ballet in 1975 and going, well, I want to do that, as opposed to win martial arts tournaments, which is kind of an interesting juxtaposition. And then the other one, there are roles that we have. And it doesn't mean that you get the role, but there are pieces that you're in where there's a synthesis of elements that catalyze. I mean, it's a catalytic thing. And it's not always based on success or recognition. There can be something that moves you. Love is like that. And I don't mean love in terms of the sappy sentimental caricature that we pointed at. And when I talk about passion, I'm not talking about a hot weekend. I'm talking about something that is unyielding over decades, which is what dance is about in theater and all of the live performing arts. It's about the dedication. So that the discipline is only a logistic organization of your passion. So the rigor is, everyone says it's 10% work and 10% talent and 90% work. I completely disagree. I think it is basically 85% passion, 5% talent, and 10% organization of your discipline. And when you're dancing or doing something like this in a company where you're not having the option, there's a huge devotional aspect where you give yourself over to that. So yes, it's incredibly demanding, but you've abandoned something somehow. Whereas if you're going to play the piccolo, going to have to find all those times to go practice all those scales on something that you can barely hold in your hot little hands. And you have to be auto-motivated. So there's a really different degree of abandonment in these kinds of things. So I feel that the passion, and I don't, like I say, to reiterate, is not this ephemeral, capricious, inflammatory state. It's an onion, like a glacier going down the valley. And if there's not a valley, well, it makes one. And I, that's what I, and the rest of it, the discipline is all. And after that, the discipline and rigor and grit and the, and all that stuff is so easy because it's just a logistic side effect.
It's funny you say it's easy though, because you know, one of my favorite podcasts to listen to is Joe Rogan's podcast. And he, prior to being a stand-up comedian, did competitive martial arts. And he often talks about that competitive martial arts were the foundations of his discipline. And that he recommends it to young men because you learn a way to be disciplined that you can apply to everything in your life. And then later he talks about applying it to stand-up comedy or podcasting or whatever. I do want to give Lindsay the chance, though, to hear about your drunk cat's whim story.
Okay, that's a super bit. Fast forward. So I quit dancing. And I had studied to become a physical therapist at the days before we even had bloody fax machines. So doing online learning was out of the question. You had to like write stuff on paper and send it into a university, and they'd send it back to you with red pencil marks all over it. And because I was touring, this was pretty interesting to figure out where you're going to be to get your lessons back. But anyways, I was studying all that online. Correspondence courses, if you will. And I'd actually had a job. I landed a job in the Zion, Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco in what was going to be elaborated as a gymnastics and sports clinic before Pilates became the rage and all the rest of it. Pilates had done his work. So I decided to take a vacation because I quit dancing. I was going to be a physiotherapist. And I went to Europe on vacation, which is a novel idea for dancers. And I had a very good friend with whom I danced in the Houston Ballet, which was, by the way, quite an interesting company. And the choreographer, Gillian Lynn, who was the co-director of Cats, also the director and creator of Phantom of the Opera, and the list is quite long, she had danced with the director of the Houston Ballet in the Royal Ballet when they were younger. She came in and she staged a ballet on us in the Houston Ballet. And that's another long, long story. Anyway, so she did that. And la, 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 la. So I went to go visit my friend Kevin, who'd been cast in the role of Mistopheles, which was a ballet, which is Wayne Sleep had been the first creator of that role. And he was an incredible ballet diva. Anyway, so I went to go visit my friend and we spent an inebriated evening. I mean, not stupid, like, you know, breaking glass. We were just having a nice, nice long time. And he said, if you're still awake tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock in the morning, you're going to the audition in Vienna, Germany. Vienna, Austria, pardon my slip there. So I was still awake. So I went to the audition. There were like 500 people there. And I'd never done anything like Cats. And I was still in shape. I was 27. So I went to the audition and I'm on a raked stage, which when you're still drunk, I'm not hungover. I'm drunk, right? not sloppy drunk and stupid, but just like not exactly prudent, how shall we say. So we did the whole audition, which is on a raked stage. And by the time we got down to the end of it, there are like five people left. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be exciting. Well, that was kind of a nice experience. And then they said, we're going to go sing. Now, in this theater, which is Theater an der Wien, Beethoven actually lived in that theater for a while. It's an iconic place. So we go up into the Probenzimmer 1, which is the rehearsal room. And there's this line of people, Trevor Nunn, Gillian Lynn, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and I didn't know who any of these people were. And they said, okay, well, I'm going to sing your up-tempo or your ballad for some, pardon me. Excuse me. And by that time, I wasn't inebriated anymore. I really wanted to go have some breakfast. And I didn't have anything to sing, so I sang Happy Birthday for them out the window while Andrew Lloyd Webber was taking notes on me singing Happy Birthday, which is kind of amusing. And so they had me go over to the piano, and the intervals in Cats said, bop, 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 bee, da, bop, bop. The intervals are very odd. So they had to check my ear, see how I could hear intervals. And then they said, you have a job. And I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do now? I'd been working to be a physiotherapist. I was going to have to write back. It's a 6-month gig. So I took the 6-month gig, which turned into a lot longer than that. Learned German and then learned how to sing, and then became the role of Monka Strap actually in 5 different productions. One of them in Paris, where we actually set it up, and I didn't speak French at the time, but Gillian Lynn brought me in as her Monka Strap for that Paris, and we created that role. And it was an interesting thing, and I saw the world and met some amazing people and continued to work on being curious. And that's where I started becoming a dance captain and then a casting director and all that other stuff through that bit.
The dance captain for a moment is interesting. Would you explain that to people who maybe are more in the circus world or theater world what the role of a dance captain is?
Well, the dance captain, all right, it's really different than a coach, because whilst coaches do a great deal of mentoring, okay, dance captains are, it's funny because you want to be a dance captain when you're not a dance captain, but when you are a dance captain, you never want to do that again. Because it's a very custodial job in many ways. There's a great deal of organization of learning, little patterns, who crosses in front of who does what. Backstage as well, by the way, because there's a great deal of choreography backstage that most people don't understand is critical to the way that works. But so you have to learn everybody's part. And then usually what happens for dance captains is they wind up being in the piece themselves. So you wind up giving corrections to your colleagues. Now that's always fun. So, and usually what happens is dance captains wind up being understudies for absolutely everybody. So somehow first cast people tend to interpret you as their assistant somehow, because when they're not feeling well, you're going to jump on stage for them, but you don't have time to prepare and you don't get rehearsal because you've been running the rehearsals for everyone else. So the dance captain, you get flung into this idea of, with no preparation and not even the care of being a swing with your musical rehearsals, no one even telling you where the props are actually set backstage, you get flung into this ridiculous role of responsibility, treated like a custodial person by all the rehearsal masters and as an assistant by most of the cast until they need you. Then you go, all right. So it's an incredible passage where if you have an ego, it's the worst possible job for you to have. If you're interested in learning the craft, it's a great one to have. And there isn't an equivalent even in some of the Cirque du Soleil shows that I was involved in. Yeah, they have dance captains, but they're basically custodians of the ography, because the organization of what goes on stage is much more stage management and coaches and physios, of course, in terms of how all that works, with the physiotherapists being mixed into that. But a dance captain in a show or in a ballet company, it's a thankless but incredibly formative passage. I would recommend it to anybody. If you want to learn something about humility, that's one place to get it.
You know, it's funny you say like the choreography backstage. We have a dance show called Babel where we have a dancer do the backstage track as an understudy, because there's so much choreography that happens with what is being moved where and when you need to place it. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have as long of a performing career as you did. I sort of bailed on at 21, but I similarly first went to casting, because what I knew as a performer was lots of other performers. And I found a way to work for somebody as casting. But what I found instantly happened was not everybody, but all of a sudden I went from being a peer to somebody who could give other people a job. And it very much changed the way, you know, a lot of people would talk to me, or just when you get approached by somebody and they know, okay, this is somebody who could maybe hire you, you get a different side of someone's personality. So I'm wondering if either you experienced that or you can sort of speak to that transition.
Oh, immensely. The first casting I did, I would be like a rehearsal master for the casting of a show in a company. So I wasn't actually casting as an agent in any way. When I was working in casting in Disney, in Paris, Disneyland Paris, I kind of fell into, I will admit. But it was also just a question of organizing things and actually understanding the criteria. So I could set up the room, I could set up the files, I could track my work, because there's a great deal of organization there. And also one of the other things that a lot of performers don't necessarily realize about casting is that we need you. I mean, we're going shopping and we need you. We're gathering and hunting and creating. We really want, and if you listen to the word audition, okay, audition, if you go into the etymology of it, it means to hear. So we want to create an environment in which people can expose themselves to what they are, because we want to see them on stage. And if you're doing casting for a show that you're responsible to produce and not just provide, that's a different role entirely. So you're going casting and then you're hiring those people, and then you're dealing with the conditions around the hiring. So you're doing ethical hiring as well. So you don't just walk off. How many times do casting directors, because it's like a salmon, if you will. So there's a problem with the contract and they come back to the casting person because you are the first contact they ever had. They swim upstream to you every bloody time. So if you're responsible for the entire food chain, it's actually better because you know what the contract conditions are. You're not advising somebody, you're responsible for it. You do responsible casting. You understand what the probation period is. You know what the rehearsal period is like, and you're actually doing that too. And then when you hire them on the show, it's a different contract because it's not the probation contract. It's the real one. Then there's the contract renewals, and then there's the whole other thing. So casting is actually a really wide spectrum depending on where you sit in with. I always agitate that casting should be the responsibility of the operations and production at the same time, because as a delivery, it's too hands off. I think it's important to be able to cast for something that you're responsible for making those people capable of doing their job. I've never wanted to do casting where I was just a service provider, if I'm making any sense.
When you said that you're the first person that people come in touch with, so they complain. There was a company who I was working for, who I was doing casting, that one of the reasons I ultimately decided to leave was because I would hire people and then I would get complaints with no ability to change anything, you know, post, because that wasn't my role in the organization. But everybody had met me on the way in, you know, so I was a friendly face for, oh, I'm unhappy about this thing.
Man, I've gotten things about, I'm lost at the ferry station. Can you help me? And I said, but I'm in France and you're in gosh knows where. It's just incredible. So there is that initial contact, which is fantastic because you are the first contact with that show. And for some people with that entire field, and I don't say industry, I use the word field. I talked about the performing arts field and I use that word very intentionally, as opposed to the entertainment industry, because it's a different mentality when you approach it that way.
Hmm. Can you explain what you mean?
What's a field? A field is a field and an industry is an industry. I mean, there you go. So the entertainment industry, yes, it's industrial in terms of its financial configuration and all the rest of it. But if you're performing, it's a performing arts field. It really is. And I know that I'm being funny about semantics, but I think that there's value in that. I think the choice of words is an architecture of thought, and I think it's important to use the words that correspond.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. I was going to say, and it kind of goes along, I guess, in a way with field versus industry, but, you know, I was contemplating how when you go for a job, you get interviewed, and if you make it further, you get interviewed for like 3 hours by a lot of people to make sure that you are cohesive with the team and your personality fits. But when I used to be a musical theater performer, and you go and you audition and you're only judged on how well you sang and acted and danced, and your personality really doesn't come into it. And that creates sometimes a great room by chance, or sometimes it's like you have a few bad apples, but they're really talented. So it doesn't matter, you know, if they can work as a team. And we started with this dance show, like interviewing every performer that we were in the last round with. And even if we knew them, because you can create such an amazing company of dancers, but it's not, I feel like when you're casting a show like a musical or a play, or even maybe a circus show, it's more about the act, less about the cohesion of a dance company or crew. And I didn't know if you could talk to that, because you actually come from the dance world where it is about, you know, working as a team versus like a performance where you're performing, you have to do your job and be done.
You're touching, I mean, if this is a podcast, it's going to be going sometime next week. The the interesting thing about having come into casting as a performer, which I think I can't understand not having a background in that. I did a lot of casting also with Cirque. And also with Daigun. And in auditions, I would try to find ways to not scrutinize people, but to still offer opportunities to observe them. What I'll say, you teach everyone some of the choreography, and we were working, say, for instance, in the show of the House of Dancing Water that played in Macau for a decade. The choreography was by a friend and amazing creator, and his name is Giuliano Pevarini. And talk about he did choreography. Also, he was the associate stage director for Franco. So he wasn't the assistant. I said associate director, and I chose that word intentionally. that movement that he actually generated, which is choreographic, is incredibly demanding. So what we would do, we would teach people the choreography, and sometimes just before they did it, we'd change one detail. And that's mean. I know they can do it, but you want to see how they react to malleability, not to be submissive and not to be obedient, but how quick they can adapt. Because that adaptability, particularly when you're going to take someone to Macau and they're going to be dealing with one of the most hostile environments in terms of the technical infrastructure, you want to see concentration. I want to see concentration and awareness more than I want to see skills. I can teach anybody choreography by doing it enough times, but you want to see how quickly they do it. And also, if someone is bitchy to everyone else in the room, I don't want them in my company. And I said company and not cast. Look at the Sondheim film Company. Watch that film. And you'll understand the difference about being in a cast and being in a company. And it's an older film, and it's actually hardcore, because it's actually a film of them doing the cast album when they've been ground into the earth with all the rehearsals and what they're trying to do. But you see that aspect of being in a trial, really. And if you don't have that aspect of solidarity, you're gonna not make it. And there are ways of testing that. And sometimes we blow it. We're working on instinct, but you're trying to be your best self. When I come to auditions, I'm much more concerned about not being aware. It's trying. And then you do all the stuff. And when you're doing all the shuffling, all the papers and the Polaroids and the staplers, and your stapler just ran out of staples, oh my God, man, it's full on, because you want that process to go well, because it actually translates into something much more significant down the road. And if you haven't been a performer and understanding what's at stake, man, when I would do cuts, I'd say, okay, anyone that wants to talk, I'm in the lobby for the next 20 minutes. Because nice. The next group is going to be learning new choreography. I don't need to watch them do that. And I would sit in the lobby and I would let these people come up to me. Sometimes they were giving me taxi receipts, which I was not involved in, but all the rest of it. And I would sit there and just be a face, so they weren't just rejected. And one time, one guy came back the next day dressed differently. You know, I'm serious. So there, and I don't mean to be human and sentimental or sort of saccharine about it, but if we don't understand that there's something vital happening in that process, the vitality of your show will reflect that.
Is there, you know, one thing I've noticed about casting, having done that now for a few different things, is how difficult it is to watch multiple people in the same room at the same time. And, you know, basically like not missing other good people, because some people naturally draw your eye to them, even if they're not the person you're looking for. Just the energy they have or what they're doing is distracting in a room. So I'm wondering, I do want to jump after this question to how you came to circus, what that transition was. But while we're on casting, is there a technique or a trick or a way in which you as a casting director have a series of things you're looking for that you're prioritizing in your brain? How do you manage to avoid just looking at everything and focus on the things you want in the room?
Well, it's a filter. First of all, you have a filter in what you're looking at. I'm not that worried about the tiny little counts usually when you're looking at these kinds of things. And you're also, what I tend to look for is their ability to be aware of space in other people, space around them, and also. What I will do when I'm sitting at a table, I'll get up and walk around. Because by the time you've got people in groups, when you're looking at like I hate to say the cattle call, I've done some cattle calls in London where you have people lined up down the street and you have them come in and they're doing four bars. Oh my Lord. I mean, really?
Four bars.
Literally, you get down to four bars. It's like, come on, what are we talking about? And that was with Disney, where we're doing like Disney cruise lines, and you have people like lined up right all the way down to the tube station at Covent Garden near Pineapple Studios. And you can see the line of people all the way down to the Covent Garden. It's nuts. And Marks and Spencer's loves that because people are constantly buying water and food. But anyway, so that's a horrendous opportunity, but I get up and I walk around. And it does the thing also that you're not standing judging them somehow, and it's a bit of a different thing. And also you see different stuff and you see different perspectives. So I mean, like we all know that to get a different idea of a sculpture, like walk around it, like Astor Square, that odd cube. I mean, you walk around it for once and then you realize that it's kind of a cool thing, huh?
That's a really interesting tip. I've always just seen it where you're all, everyone's sitting in one spot and that's where all the energy of the room is being focused to. Yeah. Okay, but I would love to hear, like, how did Circus, Cirque du Soleil, Dragon come into your life? Did it seem like a natural transition, dance to circus? Did it seem very foreign?
Oh, wow. Well, okay, I have to, you're asking long questions and I'll try to be as succinct as possible. Okay, I was in Vienna, Austria. As a cat, having recovered from my inebriated evening. And my child, my daughter was born in there. And this Cirque du Soleil was in town. And I didn't really know much about that. I was pretty much in my musical theater thing in Vienna, which I wasn't actually. And it was, so the Saltimbanco, the show Saltimbanco came in 1990, way back, galaxy far away. And I went to go see the show and we were sitting, behind one of the pillars. So I'm actually to the side of the stage and I could see the backstage ramp going up in the, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen Saltimbanco, but the band, the musicians of which there are five are on sort of like a little stand underneath the what they call the rosas, which is like a tree. Misha had cut into the beautiful set and then the whole thrust of the big top. And then of course you're in the big top, so it's round, but I didn't have a very good seat. And I was watching this show and it's like, oh, that's cool. I'd heard that Cirque du Soleil was cool, so I was just kind of sitting there in a matinee on a Saturday. And these characters started emanating from the backstage, and I could see them backstage, and I could see them come out. And I was like, what is that? I never got that answer, but what is that? And I was watching the interesting thing about that was watching things come backstage and then go backstage and then seeing the performance, which is actually quite frontally thrust, even if it's in a big top. The performance is quite frontally thrust. And it just, and I had a sort of a tear trickle down my eye, but I wasn't being sentimental about it. I thought, I wish my daughter could see this when she gets old enough to see it. She was months old. Many, many, many moons later, I was actually working in Disney and we just opened the second park in Paris. And I'd done all of the opening speeches for all of the different animations and the casting for the entire second park, which were non-plush, as we say. Actors and then wrote all the script for all the stuff, all the ceremonies and the whole thing. And it was a bit of a job. And I'm like 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, and Michael Eisner had come in and they'd all just waltzed into the park. And I was going to go back to my little office and continue to finish some artist contracts. And I'm sitting there to sit with my makeup on, having done the entire inauguration in 8 languages. And then my job was going on. I said, you know, I've had enough of this. So I just thought, what have I seen in the last decade that really moved me? And I thought, that's Saltimbanco. So I sent in just, you know, Cirque du Soleil. I speak French. I just sent in my resume and I pushed go. And they wrote back to me. And they invited me to Montreal, actually, to interview me either as casting, because they need people for casting. And it's critical. And then they also were looking for their position of artistic director for Saltimbanco. And I was fortunate enough that they offered me both jobs, and I had the fortunate dilemma of choosing moving to Montreal to be a dépisteur artistique and go to Europe and run all over the place and go to festivals and be important, or to go on tour and grind my tits. And I really thought about it for about 8 seconds, and then I went on tour because I'd been on tour for most of my life. I mean, I know what it's like being on tour and the solidarity and the challenges and the rest of it. And also I came to that because of the show. And I learned a great deal. I spent all of my time not in the rehearsals, but in the trainings. I learned all of the vocabulary for the bungees. I learned all of the vocabulary for the Chinese poles. I watched the way that the pushers and the flyers were dealing with getting on and off the swing and the Russian swing, how that works, the degree of not making them afraid, but then keeping the vigilance at 1,000,000%, dealing with how lighting is in, trying to understand how to light a juggler. So when they're juggling and they're going to juggle up, you need to move the light up first so they can juggle into a pool of light that they can still see the balls. But then when the balls are coming down, you need to accompany so that they can see it because they know where their hands are. So trying to sit and understand how to light a juggler, how to deal with all of this other stuff, it was incredible. And at the same time, preserve the staging, try to work with Franco Dragon's staging and actually propose new things because the show was already old. It was an amazing environment.
And just to pause you right there. Sorry, Matthew.
Go ahead.
it's amazing that Salty and Banco is the show you worked on, because after doing, you'll be like our 100th and first or 100th and second interview. There have been a number of people who Salty and Banco is the catalyst show and what connects. Mm-hmm. It's like the through line connecting a lot of people, like Seven Fingers, for example. A lot of them connect on Salty and Banco. A lot of the people who run the New England Center for Circus Arts, Elsie and Serenity Smith, you know, come from the Salty and Banco world. It's just, it's honestly unbelievable to me, of all the shows that happened in, you know, the last 30 years, the people who are now at the top of the industry, or maybe I would say top of the industry pre-COVID, when the field industry or field, depending on the semantic use of it, you know, touch Salty and Banco in this really interesting way.
Well, that's where I actually met Seb and Shayna, was on Salty and Banco. And Gypsy was also on Salty and Banco, but not when I was there. And Seb and Shayna came back actually for a while after they left, and they were in the throes of developing Loft, their first show with Seven Fingers, and that was so. But Salty and Banco was catalytic, and for many ways, it was also very catalytic for the Cirque du Soleil. It was the first one that was in a big top that was 2,500 and not 850. It was the first show that they did whereby they actually took that amount of time to create it. It was also like the third or fourth show with Michel Kret and Franco and everybody else. And it was the beginning of a real, I mean, they'd done a great deal of visionary work prior to that, but that became like the production. And it really, it launched Cirque du Soleil, also because it toured so widely. It opened many markets, but it didn't just open many markets, it opened hearts. I mean, I had one experience, and I'll try to make it as quick as possible. I was on Salty and Banco. We were in, I want to say, Gijón, Spain. And I'm in between shows, actually, matinee and the rest of it. I got my radio on, and can someone from Artistic come to the concession tent? So I go to the concession tent. I'm wondering who's going to complain about what here. And I see this guy in a wheelchair with a Baxter, like a drip, 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 and a nurse, like holding this oxygen mask on this guy with bottles in the back. And he'd been in the handicapped seating, and he was pulling his mask off because he wanted to talk to me. And his nurse is like trying to thrust that mask back on him. And he said that he knew he'd been diagnosed with terminal cancer many months ago, and it was told that he was going to have 6 weeks. And he bought a ticket for Salty and Banco, and he stayed. He said, now I can leave because I've lived. And he walked away from me, and rolled away from me. I thought I was going to just decompose right there. What can you possibly say to someone who says that to you? He said, I have seen so much life today, I can now walk away. And I'm like, oh my. So I went backstage, kind of walked around the big top, and I was reeling because it was intense. I walked into the artistic tent. So I was like, yeah, have you seen the bread is so hard in the kitchen? I'm like, okay. I was like I'm not so important. Not in the mood to do this. I mean, the idea about like, so I just kind of walked away, and I didn't slam the person, and I waited a few days. And then I told the story of that in the Tapis Rouge, which is the weekly meeting. And I didn't chastise anybody for having their head up their ass. I just told that story, and I said, what we do isn't fluff. What we do is not fluff. Don't forget that. That doesn't mean that it's a mission. We're not missionaries. But what we do is not fluff. So remember that as serious as you take it is what's going to go. So remember this. And the person who had complained to me about the bread came up to me wailing in tears. And I said, I didn't say that to you because I didn't need to push your head into the wall. It was tempting. But what I want is I want the lights to come on in your eyes rather than plunge them into you. So don't feel remorse. I just regret for you that you weren't there to see this man say that. And funny enough, she never talked about bread in the kitchen ever again. But these kinds of things, and this is a brilliant thing about something like Salty and Banco, because what in the world could possibly make somebody have that? Could you ever have it as a tangible reason? No. But it inspired many, many people to perform. They came out of it really, really ignited something quite substantial. And then the Cirque du Soleil, of course, expanded immensely, as we all know the stories. And Franco did his own thing. He created quite a few shows with the Cirque. And then with Taigan, what was interesting, at the end of the tour of Salty and Banco, when we closed Salty and Banco in Rio, in the big top, the arena tour was a bit of a different discussion. But we closed that debacle. And then I was asked by one of Franco's assistants to come in and do a special event in Macau because I was viewed as a local resource. I'd actually met Franco when we were on tour with South Imbaco. He came to Milano to do a press conference for South Imbaco, although he was working with his own company, but he was kind of doing it as a favor to the Cirque, but at the same time to promote his own show, Le Rêve, in Vegas. And he came in a private jet and there were all these people around and a bit sycophantic, I will say. And I was way off in the back, but he's an incredibly perceptive man. Unreal. He looks around the room and he kind of goes, da, 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 da. And who are you? Who are you? And then, not placing people hierarchically, just figuring out who's in the room. And who are you? My name is Matthew. And he looked at me and was like, that's not enough information. Well, and I told him, I'm actually the current resident artistic director on South Imbaco. He said, ma parli italiano? I said, certo, sì. He said, sit here. So he just brought me next to him. I'd never met the man. So he did the whole interviews and for the Italian television with me, speaking about him being the janitor who started the thing and me being the current papa. And at the same time, he was testing me to see what I had to say, but it was an immense risk. I could have said God knows what, but he's an incredibly intuitive man. And he put me in the hot seat. That's not a hot seat. That's a blazing hot seat. So I'm there, and at the end he said, "So let's have lunch." And he told everyone else to go away. And it came like nose to nose. And he said, "If there's one thing in the show that you change, what would it be?" And I'm usually asking people to be preserving things like some sort of incredible gospel, and that's exactly what he doesn't do. He wants you to get it. He wants you to understand what it's about, so that it lives 20 years and it doesn't become calcified in some sort of odd mission. And I said, well, what I would do would be X, Y, Z. I would actually do this. He grabbed me by the ears and gave me a very non-COVID lip-to-lip kiss. And then he said, you can do with the show whatever you want. And I said, that's fantastic that you say that. Guy might have a different idea about that. But there we go. And that was the beginning of my rapport with Franco, which was not always a non-COVID something like this. But what it was is I talked about something that wasn't a cosmetic change. It was a way of taking something in his staging that I felt hadn't been finished. And it was pretty brazen, actually. And he said, do it. He said, do it. And so this man, who is an incredible creative genius, incredible, he does it by soliciting creativity out of lots of other people, including the designers. They don't call them designers. He calls them concepteurs, which in French means concept, but we call them conceptors in English. It doesn't work in English, but it's the same idea. You do a design and then you walk away from the design. But when you're involved in the conception, you have a different degree of engagement and you keep it. So I'm kind of fast forwarding into Franco, who is unbelievable. Does he sign every instant of what's on that stage? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it's not just about his process. I mean, and it's not necessarily without messing up your hair. I mean, when you do a rehearsal session with Franco, you don't necessarily come out of it smiling. You might not sleep for a few months. It's not because he's being unpleasant. It's just because if you think that this is, it's vital. He goes into a theater that costs $250 million and then they want him to lay a golden egg. Yeah. You think someone's going to take that in a nice, relaxed way? That's one of the most perilous environments imaginable. In addition to the security aspects of plunging from 26 meters into dark water with all kinds of other stuff, there's a level of engagement in those buildings that you can't muck around with, period. And not to be scared, you have to be there. You have to be present. You can't be scared, because if you're scared, you're not present. So to get back to the cats, I took a break and I went back and did a Southern Korean tour of Cats in 2014. It was fun after 20 years of archiving Cats to be out there doing it again as a resident director and swing at the age of 57. Thank you very much. In the Lycra and the hair.
Oh my God.
But I missed the engagement of the Cirque, which was actually when I go in the Cirque. I missed that engagement. I mean, people would go out there, I mucked up my lines. I was like, yeah, that's a problem. I said, oh, well, they're Korean. They won't understand. No, you mucked up your lines. It means you weren't on stage. it's not about the Korean audience. It's about actually Thomas Stearns Eliot. You have the luxury of doing a show that has a libretto by Thomas Stearns Eliot.
Right.
And you're taking this lightly? What are you talking about? So, but in our shows, the life-threatening aspect of it is a reality, but also the degree of interactive engagement. You're not just in the thing about like doing an Evel Knievel diving over the Grand Canyon. You're hanging onto someone else's lifeline as well. And that level of engagement that I felt from working in this, and that incredible visceral nature that we have all the way through those things, including the staging, is a degree of intensity and growth which transforms people beyond the art.
Is there a cultural difference when it comes to creating work or just as process between your time at Cirque and your time at Dragon? Of course, a lot of Cirque shows are Dragon shows, particularly the famous ones that people remember. But as far as just like two different companies that are creating somewhat similar products, was there a difference in ethos or style or genre that you could, you know, speak to?
I would be a little bit unqualified to talk about that because in the Cirque, I only did Saltimbanco. I wasn't involved in the creation, although I spent a great deal of time with many of directeurs de création on different shows and all the rest. It's kind of like a recipe. There's really not a lot you can mess with. And also the Cirque does that really, really well. And Franco was part of that. So the correspondence of that is immense. And the whole idea of, you know, research and development, training and formation. I mean, these chapters are sequential. They need to be happening. And different people, I can assume that Franco is not the only one that ever did good work with the Cirque du Soleil, by any means. By any means. It had a different degree of enigma because of where his creative mind is. But many of those conceptors did many shows with the Cirque without Franco. So Franco has done brilliant work since the Cirque, and they've done some brilliant work with other people. But the ethos, perhaps in terms of the company, are a little bit different because the Cirque du Soleil was a true multinational. It had a headquarters, and it had annexes of it, but it had an entity, and then it had partners and sometimes joint ventures and all the rest of it, whereas Dragon is and was a company that was centered around the shows themselves. And say, for instance, between The House of Dancing Water, it's a Melco show. L'Appel, it's Al Habtour. The Han show is Wanda. Splendor is actually Sunak. And then all of these things. And so it's not just a detail about who actually does it geographically. Each entity becomes linked by his creativity, but not linked through the mores of the company like an HR structure. Of course, we replicate and propose different models upon which to treat employees, but they're quite geographically different. And the only person that actually was multi-show after delivery was myself when I was what they called, I actually created my own job title. I called it the Senior Artistic Director of Operations. And I did that for a specific reason because the acronym is SEGO. And I wanted to see if anyone would actually pay any attention to that. But that's actually what it was. I mean, I was responsible for the artistic direction, which includes the coaching and all the stuff and the operational models and the onstage content of multiple shows of that are actually direct competitors. So The House of Dancing Water and L'Appel are direct competitors on the work market, not for ticket sales, but on the work market. We need divers. We need people. And because the actual contractual entities were completely distinguished, yes, they have the Franco's magic, but they have the sort of half brothers and half sisters. So yes, they're the familial link to him, but amongst themselves, not really. So keeping any coherence in that was the job that I spend a lot of time doing, which you also know from speaking with François Girard is something that Franco really wants to hold. And at the same time, from a strict contractual standpoint, it's quite difficult.
You know, one thing that I feel like is preached in art in general is like write what you know. That I feel like is a cliche that people hear a lot. And you know, when we did our first show called Slumber, we made it in Brooklyn. We did it for Brooklyn audiences. And then we took it to Australia and we're like, oh my God, none of this humor is working in Australia at all. And it was really our first exposure to you make something and then you assume it will work in another country of English speakers, you know, who look and sound like us. But it doesn't, and different things click and connect. And a lot of the Dragon shows, you know, with Larev being the exception, are outside of the U.S. in Canada. And I'm wondering what things you saw or noticed about creating shows for foreign markets. I mean, Asia in particular, I think, is interesting. But I think it could be viewed in the most cynical light, like, oh, who are these, you know, Montreal Quebecers coming into, you know, Asia trying to make a show for an Asian audience. But then, of course, there's the flip side of that, of that's the special product that's unusual in that territory that people would like because it's different from other things. So I'm wondering if you can just speak to that, like creating shows for foreign audiences.
Yeah, well, we don't need to serve Chinese food to Chinese people, okay? And it's important not to. So there's an educative process that's there. So there's one reflex, which is we don't care. We're exotic. We're cool. We have a brand. They're going to come, which is one approach. It's not very successful. I saw that once in Asia of, you know, we're a family name. And that went into the wall like multiple times. That's fortunate. And it actually, like, it leads into a subject that I want to put a marker on, which is what I call dynamite fishing. But that's, I'm using that word quite consciously. But within, and it's not any kind of comparative value with the House of Dancing Water that I can speak of because we worked in it. We ran it through, not like beta testing. We wanted to make really sure that our respect of iconography and our respect of patrimony wasn't going to be precious. We're not performing this at the museum. And actually, iconoclastic artists in Asia go far, 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 and they provoke very intelligent, and they don't all wind up in jail. So, but still, they know where to push. They know where to push. So don't just consult, learn. So Franco is an avid reader. I don't know where, I mean, he probably sleeps like once a week. I mean, how that man devours books, I don't understand. And he reads all of it, also just on him. He's autodidact. I mean, self-taught. He didn't grow up at La Sorbonne. He comes from a very, very rustic, small immigration town in central southern Belgium. That guy is a self-taught man. I mean, illuminated in many ways. But he really listened to how he could find the iconography, not as a marketing hook and not as some kind of way to seduce people into paying attention. So we use the iconography where it actually resonates with people and not where they recognize. There's a huge difference there. You can recognize yourself in the mirror and then that gets boring because you're looking to find something else. But when you find a place to resonate with, it's different. And then you can use it in a nonverbal way. Symbolism. Okay. But Franco uses emotional iconography and cultural iconography very well. So understand the Hansho. It's in the Han Basin. And one of their main symbols are bells. It's part of the thing, not like little tinker bells, but bell bells and horses. It's the Han Basin. Everyone knows about Hua Mulan, okay? But it's not, we're not doing Mulan. So we don't necessarily have to come up with a chick who's gonna be a soldier and cut off her hair. So all we, but you know how you have to understand that. And then you can pick and choose and decide where to have a resonance that isn't a reproduction. And then you find those things. So it's an educative process, but they're not touring shows. If you're in touring shows, that's a bit of a different debate entirely. When Saltimbanco goes to Japan and we think we're going to bring a woman up on stage and Eddie the Clown's going to be making a mocking, you don't mock women in that society. Mm. Okay? Or people won't even come out of their shell because they don't. So, but that's a touring thing. Or when you take, say, for instance, Kidam to Abu Dhabi or to Dubai and the tissue act, which is beautiful. Well, you're not going to necessarily put her in a wetsuit. But she can't go out there in that thing because they're not looking at the physical architecture of beauty. It's too shocking for them. And so there are ways of doing it. Either you cut the act or you modify it. So there's a lot going on there with the cultural iconography. So if you'll allow me to rebound onto one other thing, which is now what? Let's look at a city country like Singapore. Gets a casino license, which means that there are huge funds that become available. And they decide to create a resort called Sentosa, and they decide that they're going to do a large casino thing, and they decide that they're going to do a big show, which will remain nameless. And they bring in really large, well-renowned creative potential, and they do this really, really expensive show, and it tanks big time. And then they bring in some more people to kind of fix it, and they spend many more millions, like millions and millions, and it tanks a second time. Okay, I saw that show. And it was an externally imported product that had absolutely, it could have been in Singapore, it could have been in San Diego. But the reason it was in Singapore is because someone decided they were producing for Singaporean financiers. And this is where I get into dynamite fishing. So we give it over to them, and then the operations, and then the demographics, and then the marketing study all of a sudden become their problem. No, that's actually not okay. Because yes, you get a delivery fee. Yes, you've done your job. You've delivered. But delivering a show is on opening night. You deliver a show that runs. You don't just deliver a premiere. And that comes down into the nature of the partnership. That can include any territory of opportunity, like Vietnam, which is now this way. And it's not because of casinos, but there is a financial aspect of building theaters that cost 150 million US pre-COVID. Okay. So all those projects, it's really important, in my unhumble opinion, to take on a different degree of responsibility when you are doing the maiden voyage. If you're coming into Vegas and doing another show now, there is a macro system that has its resiliency there, that is there. But when you're bringing in a show to Macau, or you're bringing in a show to Wuhan, you're bringing in a show to Dubai or Singapore or on and, it's really important to accept a certain degree of responsibility and not telling them how to do it. But you need to have more than just delivery of your goods, because the macro system is part of our field, our industry, an ecosystem. And if we just deliver and they blow it from their marketing, or because they've blown it on their estimation of construction deadlines and all the rest of it, and it tanks, but you've done your job, that level of disengagement is irresponsible. And in post-COVID, we cannot afford that anymore, because the only beacons of a reprise of our craft are an intelligent engagement, which includes touring. We can no longer be a Tupperware that rocks into town, opens up the cover, puts some money in there, spreads a little love, and then leaves. My opinion is that we need to take a different degree of engagement in our itinerant shows, being touring, or above all, in when we're creating something that's usurping a great deal of local resources. I don't think that the way that the oil industry is working in Nigeria is very positive. And I don't think that dynamite fishing is okay. So when we're going to be going back into territories that are hungry, like Saudi Arabia and China and other parts of China, and going in for opportunity, I think we need to bloody move there and not deliver. That's what I think. Pardon me for being so forthcoming, but there you go.
No, it's very interesting. I mean, I've seen it also on the flip side, when foreign things come to New York City and it's like, I don't get this at all, but it makes sense in a different context. And also, it's interesting what you say on these like categorizations of a touring project being sort of fundamentally and philosophically a different game than the permanent built company. Mm-hmm. You know, one, mm-hmm. I do want to ask a little bit about COVID, but just one thing on the topic of these like $150 million theaters. Do you feel like it changes at all the artistic incentive when the numbers are that enormous, basically?
Totally. It's not even a question of numbers. If one does a show for a producer, an entrepreneur who's going to spend maybe $200,000 on the research process, you're talking to somebody who's fronting some money. When you're talking about 150 million in a building before it even starts anywhere, you're talking to a board of investors. You're talking to ties, suits and ties. And I know some really cool visionary suits and ties. So this is not what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but you have a different process. And also you have to realize that their ROI, return on investment, is not a certainty. As a matter of fact, it usually takes up to 2 years post-opening for the operational P&L, being profit and loss, to actually even out. So if you're going to be building a building like that, that's an initial investment that you probably don't get an ROI on directly, if you can actually have something that's good enough and bring people to your property so that you're augmenting your restaurants, your hotels, and people coming in and all the traffic outside of the direct financial quantifiable envelope. That's fine. But expect to refund your ROI is a bit delusional. So it's our responsibility to explain that to people. So the way that you get this, so I don't even like the word P&L, profit and loss. So everything you come in is profit, and everything that leaves the building is loss. So when you pay tuition for your kid, is it a loss? No, it's an investment. So the cyclical aspect of the finances, there are some things that are lost, and we need to identify those. Some of it is revenue. So your revenue surfaces, your revenue sources need to be diversified so that you don't view every single expenditure as a loss, so that the minute you're losing on cash, you start cutting cast, you start cutting resources. That's crazy. Well, I'm going to let you go studying, but I'm going to cut your bandwidth, and you can only go on internet for 3 hours a day, but you're having to study online. That's not intelligent financial management. So yes, it changes the content, and also because there's approvals. Even a visionary, they don't make unilateral decisions. And the artistic director doesn't make unilateral decisions. So the identity of your product will be to a certain degree compromised, and you're not producing it necessarily to a theatrical audience. Now, here's something I said. This is only personal, so it's not an expression on the behalf of any other company. In one of our company meetings in Macau, people were talking about the theater, and they were all so, well, we don't have any theatrical values. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very sophisticated performance venue, producing a very sophisticated entertainment product on an industrial scale with a very refined theatrical component. It ain't a theater, there ain't no ghost light, and there ain't no repertory. So you have to understand, walk through the casino, walk through the merch tent, come in, then you realize who's sitting there. And that's not to denigrate them. It is not a theatrical endeavor. It is an entertainment project on an industrial scale with an extremely sophisticated theatrical component. And now let's go to work. Now, that's just me. So anyone that disagrees with that, they can disagree with me personally. I'm not expressing myself on the behalf of anyone else.
But no, but it's interesting because it also attracts a different audience. If you set it up as theater versus what it is, also your expectations of who's in the audience change based on how you frame that conversation.
But I also feel like people in audiences in America are, you know, a whole other hurdle for circus specifically.
Oh, totally.
You know, because they're not thinking of it as anything theatrical. And well,
look at shows like Kidam. Look at Kidam. Kidam was an absolute masterpiece, but not that many people liked it. I mean, in Her Majesty's Theater, Phantom ran for, I mean, right. Sweeney Todd. I mean, if you want to look at these kinds of things, the degree of articulation in most online pieces, but even pieces like Sweeney Todd, which wears... It's of course an illustrative example, and somehow Kidam and Sweeney Todd are not necessarily very equitable, but Kidam goes to Japan and people are like, huh, really? Or if you took Sweeney Todd and put it on the stage somewhere else, I mean, it's not because it's so sophisticated, although it is. It's an incredibly sophisticated piece on all possible levels, but still. So there is that, and it's not about dumbing it down. It's about having something that actually makes sense. Mm-hmm. But there are companies that take risks, and whereas it's also important because you have to cultivate an audience. And I don't mean cultivate, but like school them. Always push the boundary a little bit. Otherwise, the boundaries will just get smaller, and then it's important to push those boundaries. And I have to say that the Cirque took huge risks in this way, and you have to really give it to them. I mean, they really put their head on the block, to be polite, on a lot of things. They took huge risks in many ways, some of them business risks. And then when they take risks and then compounding risks, then it becomes risky versus dangerous. There's a difference between danger and risk. So ascertaining when you're in the risk zone or the risk category and in the danger zone is a different reading. And I think that that's part of what led up to where we are now with that. I mean, it's a tragedy that that company folded, and that if they resuscitate, that will be a very good thing for everybody. But it's not just because of job opportunities. But I will hope that there will be a bit of a reboot there, more than just starting up machinery again. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes when you reboot your computer, it's so that it actually starts reading the programs correctly. Well, let's do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think just talking about Cirque for one quick moment, like, I would be more optimistic if the new private equity company didn't just put another $600 million of debt on Cirque after coming out of bankruptcy. So they've really they've really shaved less than half of the position they were off, you know, pre-2019. But, you know, only time will tell. I'm only rooting for them, even though we talk shit, you know, sometimes on our podcast. I do love Cirque, and I would love to see them back. I'm curious, what was going on for you as COVID hit? Were you watching these shows in Asia shut before it was happening in the U.S.? How did that sort of all unfold for you?
Oh, it was pretty quick. I mean, also one of the things is with Igon, we have a show in Wuhan. We're like, ooh, I call it Wuhan. I was like, oh man, okay, that was exciting. COVID hit. So when did COVID hit? I guess November-ish. That's when people started to pay attention to it.
Yeah, in Asia.
I was in Macau. We were starting to look at it, kind of okay. But whenever I'd come from Dubai, because I was also working often in that, I mean, I have to come into Hong Kong, and people weren't worrying about me coming from China. They were talking about MERS, Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. So people looking at me like, so when I was coming into China, they're looking at me like some contagion rather than the other way around. So I was in and out of Hong Kong, Macau area, going back and forth to Dubai a lot. And then we'd finished a bit of a job in January in Dubai, and then everything just kind of completely shut down. When that actually slammed shut, I was actually on the jury of the Festival Mondial de Cirque du Demain for the third time. Actually, it's a fantastic opportunity. Also being a judge is a drag, because you're actually holding a lot of responsibility there in terms of judging, and that's what you're doing. You're not auditioning, you're judging. So I was there, and then we started looking at just the travel restrictions. I mean, it's a very fundamental thing. I mean, when you can't get audience, then you kind of close down, you pare down. And the House of Dance and Water actually ran for quite a while to only Macau audiences, just to keep the machine going, more or less. They actually ran for almost 6 months like that, with like 3% audiences. And it's not because it wasn't selling well. Sell to who? I mean, Macau is a peninsula with a huge international traffic, but when that traffic stops, that's talk about slamming the doors. And so I would just watched all those things slam down. And it was, of course, devastating, because you know how many people are out of a job, and many of them are not even able to travel. They can't travel. And so one of the things with watching what happened with the Cirque closing its activity, because they had two huge activities, the shows where people were actually resident wherever they are, and their work permits or green cards, some of them are linked to their job, but there's a bit of intelligence behind that process, so people aren't just like ejected immediately. But on tour, you have to go home. Now, when you're on tour, for those kinds of shows, home is an interesting concept, because many people have been on tour for sometimes almost a decade. Their schooling is either homeschooling with other people. Their housing, they don't go back to their sublet apartment in Hell's Kitchen. I mean, they don't. And very often, sometimes their children are of a different nationality than the country that they're an origin of. So just going back to where it is, and all of a sudden you're going to bring the whole kit and then sleep on your mom and dad's couch. Interesting. So then you're going to rent an apartment if you ever manage to do that. Good luck, because you don't have a job. First and last month rent, and then a deposit. That was huge. And I think that if I will allow myself to be a little bit ambitious, I think that treating everyone fairly doesn't mean that treating everyone the same. And I think that there was a little bit of a lack of discernment in treating the people as touring staff in the exact same way as people that are working in fixed environments where they already have a house. They already have all these other things. And I'm not talking about shelter. I'm just talking about even administratively a way of going about their own health insurance and all the rest of it. So when you're on tour and you really are stranded, getting back to a point whereby you can just kind of hunker down and wait for this all to pass is a very different reality. And Daigon didn't have that, but I observed that, and I saw hundreds of my brothers and sisters in very, very compromised situations with the way that slammed down. And I don't think that the repatriation of touring staff was handled very well.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely touring, I think, will be the last thing to return. Yeah. I'm very curious to see if tents return, period, in the way they happened with Cirque.
Well, I think also what we've been noticing just like from the outside and having friends is the the lack of transparency, which I understand because A, it's a huge company, and B, like, no one knows really what's going to happen, and trying to predict it is very hard. But like the dangling of hope of like, we're hoping we're coming back. You know, I think a lot of performers are like, well, that's, I'm hoping too, you know, instead of being like, we're definitely unsure and I don't think we're going to come back for a bit. It's just like the same message, but, you know, one's more realistic and one's more.
Yeah, it's the slow burn versus just like grabbing the knife and taking the taking the pain.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it kind of goes back to what I was saying. Don't tell us, this is going to sting a little bit, and all of a sudden you're writhing in pain. Right. I mean, that doesn't help much. When they give you the bullet and they say, you're going to bite the bullet, which comes from, you know, all those Westerns, you know, bite the bullets because you want to, sometimes you need to bite the bullet. And I think it's actually, it's a delicate subject, but it's important to be honest with oneself in a crisis situation. When you hear things like, oh, we're going to have some optimizations. Okay. Or redundancies, staff redundancies. Like, okay, let's not call this BS. It's really important not to beat around the bush, to speak politely. So in a situation whereby a company, any company, and I've been in multiple organizations like that, realizes that they're going to have to be this, they don't call it optimizations. You're going to have to do a severe restriction of expenditures to keep, it's a survival thing. Mm-hmm. It's not an optimization. We're already running optimally. We no longer have optimal resources, so we have to go into survival mode, not optimization. So don't give me this euphemistic bullshit about optimization. Don't tell me my position is redundant and then hire somebody the next week less expensive. Mm-hmm. If my position were redundant, you wouldn't rehire somebody. So offer me a job for 15% less. Try that. So let's stop mucking around. Let's do that. We're going to have a redeployment. Oh, we have a redeployment programming, which is just a list of best intentions. Do you have jobs for those people to be redeployed? Yes or no? Don't tell me whether you have a redeployment list. If you have a redeployment list of 750 people, that's a production problem and not a redeployment problem. So this degree of honesty in organizations that need to restructure is important, because if you have any chance of getting your staff to understand what it is and educating them, it's to be transparent is a bit of a limpid word for it. I would say educative. We are in survival mode. It is not certain that we're going to be able to survive this. We need to take some drastic measures. And it's not, oh, well, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. That's a bit too odd, or no pain, no gain, or some other just ridiculous, like brainless statements. But we are going to do whatever we can to survive. It is our intention to do X, Y, and Z. And then you try to find a way, if you can, to cut a retainer fee with people that allows them to do other things, that keeps basic stuff over their head that's not an expenditure, but like an insurance policy, or any kind of other way that you can give any kind of gesture that's not hope. Somehow, like, what is it? Pixie dust. Pixie dust doesn't make the grit that people need to do these jobs. Sorry. I wish it did. I would invest in pixie dust.
So, unrelated question. You mentioned earlier you have a daughter. Would you push your kids to a circus dance world, or would you keep them, would you steer them away from it?
Neither. My daughter spent 3.5 years on tour with us in Saltimbanco, but she was actually in the show as an on-stage character, just because we needed to have some of the other kids go home because they'd already been on site for too long for the schooling and labor laws for minors. And it's good. So touring with minors is another podcast entirely. But anyway, so yes, she's done that. She was exposed, very widely exposed. And she did a great deal of circus performing then, and was actually quite talented at it. And then she came back to Europe after the tour and went to a circus school, a good circus school in France. And they wanted her to actually work. and she came to that. She's also got a brilliant voice. And the physical structure is there. She's got talent just oozing and oozing and oozing. And I didn't push or steer, but she's quite widely exposed. And I'm very happy to say that her passion is actually elsewhere. So the fact that her passion is elsewhere is not a concession. So she's not a wannabe. And she's also not a should have been. So that's a nice place to sit. And I don't think that that performers that say, well, don't do what I do, you know, it's a rough life. I think that that's a terrible thing. I do. But I mean, there will be certain children that want to emulate their parents, and maybe that's okay. But I think when if they're really smitten, it's a terrible thing to actually can say, yeah, but what are you going to do for as a real living? I mean, come on, really? And then also to push them into it as some sort of patrimony that you're going to create this mark. I don't know. I mean, funny enough, some of the more talented cinema actors who have famous parents change their own stage names because they don't want to be inappropriately associated with that. And I think it's a good thing because it allows them to develop artistically within their own right, I think.
Yeah, I think so. We have a few years to navigate that problem with, but I have been asking it of a few different
still working on,
circus parents.
Crawling.
But we do wrap up all our podcasts with the same three questions that everybody gets. The first one being, is there a piece of advice, either really good or really terrible, that somebody has given you that has stuck with you?
I guess I'm too sassy to take on terrible advice. I guess there's a certain degree of good advice. Oh, wow. Tell me the three and I'll answer that one.
Okay.
Can you let me do that? Can you let that work on the back burner while I try
to answer? Yeah, sure. I mean, the advice I'm taking very literally from this podcast is to walk around the room
I'm
casting. That I'm taking personally.
Yeah.
But okay, second question. We'll circle back to that first one. Is for somebody who's a student of any age, but somebody trying to learn about circus and the arts, is there a movie, a TV show, a book, a live show, and live shows can return that you love and would recommend somebody check out?
Okay. Specifically about circus performing, that's a little bit more just to give them an exposure to the kind of circus that unfortunately we don't see anymore. There's a film called Trapeze, actually, and it's really a fantastic. And if I'm not incorrect, it's Tony Curtis, I believe, was in that film, and it's old, but it's got all the icons. It's got the flashy diva suits and the trapeze and all the intrigue and all the stuff, and it's absolutely marvelous. It's not water for elephants. It's a marvelous fantasy, but studied. You have the impresario who's a fat, exploitative person who's kind of lusting after her in a drooling way, and the odd sort of stuff and the kind of magic of the sawdust and all the other stuff. But it's well enough studied that it's interesting that you realize also the degree of engagement that's there and all that. And it's a passionate film, and I'm an old soul. I'm an older person. But I think it's kind of nice to remember that circus comes from circus, you know, and the way that it families and the tradition that goes there. I mean, I could say go see Freaks. That's kind of cool. On Fellini, that's kind of wild. But that's circus, but in terms of the oddity of it. But with the passion of the film Trapeze, which is a very old, I think it was done in the 50s. I'm not wrong. And it's almost like watching Fantasia. But any illustrator will drool in front of Fantasia. So there's times like that when that's one of those films. And that doesn't mean that they don't do contemporary circus and that they're doing research of how they're doing their sear wheel. But go see Trapeze and remember how vital that is to people from the standpoint of accomplishment. Also just that it is beautiful and fantastic and miraculous. I was in the Roncalli Circus at one time and seeing the way that they took care of just the big top, and it was so enchanting. And remember that when those audience members are there, that it's not just about how ripped you are, and it's a vital thing. I'd go see Trapeze.
Great recommendation.
Do you have an answer for the first one, or do you want the third question?
Give me the third one, baby.
Okay, third one. Who do you think we should have on our podcast?
Okay, that's easy. I think he'll probably say yes. I would like you to interview a man named James Tanabe.
Oh, I know James.
James is, I think almost no one knows James. He's known, but first of all, James is a scientist. He studied molecular biology at MIT. He did some stuff with NASA, looking at some of the aerial spatial things. He was also in the École Nationale de Cirque as a graduate and a circus performer. He did New Circus Asia all over everywhere for very, very social circuses all through Asia. Straps and handstand performing, worked in the cabaret circuit. He worked on Wintuk, worked as the artistic director of Corteo, worked as the senior director of business development directly under Dan Namar after the acquisition of the Cirque. He's one of the more, he's probably a Highlander. I mean, you look at a guy who was in his early 40s and where in the bleep did you learn all that at that level? It's unreal. So his skill level is incredibly developed on all those levels. But what's interesting about him, among other things, other than the fact that he's just very, very gifted and incredibly intelligent, he associates the core lessons of all those different things. So it's not like he is some sort of odd Rolodex. He actually has the cognitive association from the grit of being a straps performer. You're not doing straps and not working hard. Sorry. And handstands, the incredible concentration that goes with that on that level, and translating that into art, and then going on stage, managing that, doing the business development for all those other things in different continents. I think that if I were a younger performer, I would really want to try to figure out how a guy like that ticks.
Yeah, he's a great recommendation. I met him when he was on Wintuck in New York. And then I think he was probably doing his MBA or some kind of studies at the time because he had finished doing ENC. Mm-hmm. But he put together, I forget what it was. It was some kind of like online video platform competition before like YouTube was that big. It was like a little too early for like video competing over the internet with circus. But it was like the first thing of that type.
Oh, cool.
But he's a really, really good recommendation and somebody I think I could probably get on here. Okay, first
I speak to him. I speak to him often, so I'll be able to. If you'd like, we can do an e reintroduction.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Anyway, so yeah, I would love to. But I think it's a very pertinent, particularly now, vision. Also, from someone who's like he's not 100 years old. I mean, you're talking to an old. You're talking to. I was in the Jurassic Ballet. You know, so the best advice I ever got: take class every day.
That's a real dancer's piece of advice in a way.
Or practice every day. I mean, we've all heard the old one, sir, how do we get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, young man, practice. That's how you get to Carnegie Hall. Even Quentin Tarantino used that in Inglourious Basterds. I was actually offended because, I mean, we've been talking about that forever. This old guy is walking down the street and the guy says, pardon me, sir, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, young man, practice. And then they use it in Inglourious Basterds. That kind of bothered me. But there is something to that. I mean, before you're starting to plant your garden based on moon cycles and stuff, mow the lawn, rake the leaves. Brush your teeth, shave your legs, say your prayers, and just get on with it. I mean, there's a place where, you can say it in a less polite thing. I mean, pull it out. Pull it out is not the most polite way of saying. Just do it. And also, there's a very famous singer. Her name is Cleo Lane. I don't believe she's with us anymore, Cleo Lane. Just incredibly a gifted jazz singer. And she said one time, don't be proud. Don't be proud. And what she meant by proud was don't be proud of yourself. I mean, don't get proud of all this. But this was part of this whole dance thing. I mean, just go to class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. I love all three answers. Yeah. Matthew, it's been so much fun talking to you. Thank you for coming on and doing the podcast. There was some real wisdom dropped on this episode. So I'm excited for folks to listen to it. I hope we can come visit you at one of these shows when we're all able to return to hanging out in person.
Oh, indeed. Great. Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to actually meeting you in the raw, as we say, seeing you face to face. Yeah.
And that was our interview with Matthew Jessner.
If you like our podcast, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Have a good almost weekend. Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.